Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, is the world ready for the next pandemic? It's a pertinent question this week since the Democratic Republic of Congo just announced the official end of the 9th outbreak of Ebola in the country. It's also a question science journalist and author Ed Yong asks in this month's Atlantic as he traveled overseas to Africa and visited medical centers here in the U.S. He writes, on average, in one corner of the world or another, a new infectious disease has emerged every year for the past 30 years. So what does that mean for the way we manage those diseases, prepare for these pandemics, and think about how they move ever more easily between animals and humans? As our guest joins us, we're going to open the phone lines for your questions and concerns about pandemics. What do you want to know about the way they spread? And what do you want to know about who's most vulnerable to them? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Ed Yong is a science journalist and the author of I Contain Multitudes. The newest article in The Atlantic is titled, When the Next Plague Hits. And Ed Yong joins us today from D.C. And Ed, welcome. It's good to have you back on the show. I know we talked about I Contain Multitudes, and it's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back. Thanks for having me.
You went to the Congo, and you noted that when you traveled there, you discovered what you call forgetfulness about Ebola. How does that square now with what has happened there and their declaration that they've now contained this 9th outbreak of the disease?
Right. So Ebola was actually first spotted in the Congo in the 1970s, and the country has experienced now 9 outbreaks of the disease. I went there to look at the aftermath of an outbreak in 1995 in a city called Kikwit, which was actually one of the ones that was first like thoroughly documented by Western journalists and really helped to bring the disease to international infamy. And I noted on my visit to that many of the conditions that were relevant to the spread of the epidemic back in the 90s are still pertinent there. There's still a lack of resources, of protective equipment. One thing that is different is that people are much more aware of the disease and aware of the signs and symptoms and ready to spot potential cases. But it's still very difficult to deal with that. Now, the bright side of this otherwise gloomy picture is that because the Congo does have all this experience of dealing with Ebola and does have a lot of trained people, they are able to respond quite quickly. And they've had the benefit of having most outbreaks happen in reasonably isolated areas that that make it harder for the disease to spread. That wasn't the case in this most recent 9th outbreak, but I think the country's experience, along with quick mobilization from the international community, helped to bring this latest outbreak to heel.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because the WHO mentioned in its release about this that they were worried that the disease had broken out in an area where people lived in more dense conditions with river connections to the capital. And yet the health professionals moved in so quickly that they were really able to contain this quickly, even given the risks of it getting to the capital and beyond.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of concern when the disease moved into this city called Bandaka, which has a population of over a million people and is on this easy river route to Kinshasa. One thing that I thought was really interesting was when this was first happening, I called a man named Jean-Jacques Muyembe, who is the first scientist ever to encounter Ebola back in the 70s, and he was actually reasonably calm. He said that it would take probably about 3 months to control this outbreak. And that's in fact what's happened. It's been 2.5 months. I think that speaks to the Congo's ability to deal with these diseases, even in a situation where they have very limited resources. They have expertise which they can marshal, and I think that does make a lot of difference.
Call for you here from Joe in Minneapolis. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good.
I read the article. It was very good. But my question is, in the article, sir, you really didn't recommend restricting travel. And because I believe you said, well, people are still going to get in, it's better to track them. But I don't understand, if we had an outbreak of Ebola again in the Congo, why not restrict travel? Why not make sure anybody who gets on a plane does not seem sick? Because like you said in the article, I believe you listed just a few hospitals, one of them in Kansas, that could handle a number of Ebola patients. We would be overrun.
Okay, so one of the problems with airport screening is that it's of limited use for these kinds of diseases because they have a long incubation time. Symptoms are often not obvious and very similar to a lot of other conditions. So it's not really a very fruitful way of spotting people who have those conditions. Historically, attempts to use travel restrictions and travel bans haven't really borne fruit with helping to control other diseases. And the worst possible outcome of all of this is that if you institute travel restrictions, you discourage people from countries like the US from traveling to places abroad and helping out with epidemics there for fear that they might not be able to return to the country. And I think that's a huge problem, because when these outbreaks flare up, as we've already said, it does really help to have support from the international community to help keep them in check. And if that support dwindles because people are worried about their ability to return home or to seek help if they get infected too, that's going to make it much harder to control outbreaks at an early stage when they can be more easily controlled.
Part of the reason that you were writing the piece on pandemics is the centennial of the flu pandemic mm-hmm. of 1918. And as I began the article, I thought, well, we're in a really different scientific world today than we were in 1918. I mean, the medicines, mm-hmm. the medical advances. What is there to really understand about something that happened 100 years ago that tells us anything about what we might confront today?
So I think there's a few things that are notable about the 1918 flu pandemic. First, just the scale of it. You know, this was a thing that killed an estimated 50 to 100 million people around the world. So that was at the time up to 5% of the world's population. And a lot of the flu pandemics that have happened more recently have involved strains that are much less potent. So I think it gives us an idea about what happens if you have a strain that is, has the transmissibility of flu, but also a very high mortality rate. You're right that things have progressed a lot since then. You know, we have huge medical advances, but there are other structural problems in the world that should stop us from being lured into a false sense of security. So for a start, the world is much more populous and much more crowded than it was back in 1918. You know, we've gone from about 2 billion people to over 7 billion people. And the vast and the majority of those people now live in urban centers, in crowded environments where infectious diseases can more easily spread. We also live in a just-in-time economy with long supply chains that run across the entire world. And that means that our infrastructure for dealing with infectious threats is is very brittle. It's very fragile, and it's especially fragile when it comes to threats that involve the entire world. So we saw an example of this just last year when Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. It knocked out a lot of the facilities that provide much of the U.S. with IV bags, a staple of the medical enterprise. So IV bags started running low, and people had to, some places were forced to inject IV fluids with syringes. And because of that, syringe supplies started running low. So we just have these sort of cascading fragilities, which I think might really cause a problem in a situation where you have a fast unfolding disease that starts spreading around the world.
So your concern is not just, are medical facilities ready to handle the influx of patients that would come in? And I want to talk to you about that in a minute. But it's also about, would we even have, what, the medical apparatus to treat the number of people? I mean, I think of something as, well, how difficult is it to lay in extra supplies? But you're saying even the tools that medical professionals would need might very quickly be in short supply. That's a pretty frightening thought.
Yeah, it is definitely something that that keeps some of the people I've talked to in public health up at night. You're right that we sort of take the availability of medical supplies for granted, but experience should tell us that their availability is more precarious than we think. There are stockpiles for sure. There is in fact a strategic national stockpile which is meant to address exactly this. But there's only so much. There are only so many materials that you can keep in check, at the ready, and so much of what we need relies on companies manufacturing things to order, and that is a problem. In that world, preparedness often comes down to the foresight of individual institutions and the people working within them to make sure that their particular place has a reasonable number of supplies.
So if you head up a hospital in Denver or in Kansas City, and you really understand the potential threat of this, maybe you've got the kind of supplies that might be ready, but it is really sort of a subjective perception about what the threat is. Is that right?
It is, and I think it's something that I think hinges more on individual will and vision than we might like as a society.
Interesting.
I went to this hospital in Nebraska, the Nebraska University Medical Center, which has not only one of the best prepared units in the country for treating people with diseases like Ebola or SARS, but has also really taken preparedness to, I think, a very commendable and extreme height. So when I went there, I saw how they had thought through really every aspect of hospital life and how it might function in a pandemic. So, if you have organ transplant patients, where do you put them in a situation where there is a fast spreading disease about the place? Like, where would you triage patients to? How many stockpiles do you need? All these kinds of questions, like which entrance do you funnel patients into? They've really thought through every aspect of this, which is great and massively reassuring for the people of Omaha, but not every hospital has gone through those kinds of exercises, and certainly not every hospital has the institutional support to prepare for something that is, a kind of nebulous threat. We all think it will happen. No one knows where, no one knows when, no one knows what exactly the threat will be. And it does take a huge amount of will and effort to keep things in the ready when we all know that there are priorities knocking on our doors right now.
Ed Yong is with us. If you've just tuned in, he's a science journalist and the author of I Contain Multitudes. And I spotted an article that he wrote for this month's Atlantic about the next pandemic. The article is titled When the Next Plague Hits. He had the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the 1918 flu pandemic to go back and look at what we've learned since, how pandemics spread today, how well prepared we are around the world, and how there are a lot of different elements of how we would spread these viruses from person to person. As he said, we're a much more densely populated world now. But how we're thinking about the idea of getting ready for the next pandemic. If you have questions about the flu, the way it spreads, how it might turn into a pandemic, what happened in 1918, be interested in hearing that. 651-227-6000, 800 if you're somewhere out in the region, 242-2828, and on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. Your piece about the flu prompted me to do some further reading, and I was looking at this research out of Oxford about the 1918 virus itself. Mm-hmm. It sounds like that flu virus was dangerous and spread quickly, but that it wasn't all that different from the other flu strains that were out there at that point. What do you understand about what made that particular flu strain so deadly?
So I think people are still looking, trying to address that question. The strain was very notable, I think, in causing these extreme immune reactions in the people whom it infected, and you know it's. There are so many different flu strains out there, and I think people are still trying to get a handle on how to what they're going to do based on the nature of the individual viruses. The CDC actually has this kind of most wanted list of flu strains out there based on their likelihood of causing problems in a potential pandemic. And I think the thing to note is that the 1918 virus was sort of unusual in pandemic strains in the effect in its effect compared to other pandemic strains that have cropped up since. But there are all kinds of other flu viruses out there right now that have, possible potential for mass harm. The top of the list is a thing called H7N9, which is currently circulating in China, and seems to have a very high fatality rate, and there are concerns about its capacity to spread from people. It's a bird flu virus, but I think one thing that's really important to talk about is that our ability to predict which strains are going to cause us problems in the future is perhaps not as strong as we would like. We can make those predictions, but as one member of the CDC who works in flu told me, it's almost like the flu virus is listening in on our conference calls, and it seems to do whatever we are least expecting. I think that's right. These diseases are inherently a bit unpredictable. And we can do our best to try and predict them, but it's difficult.
You mentioned that the H7N9 flu strain is at the top of the CDC's list of what flus to be concerned about, flu strains to be concerned about.
That's correct.
What makes this one particularly concerning?
So it has to do with its fatality rate. It has caused several outbreaks within poultry in China in recent years, and has successfully jumped to humans on several of those occasions. China seems to have taken steps to control that particular virus that have been reasonably successful, but there's always something, and I think it's always the strains that we don't see coming that I think we should be concerned about. In the piece I wrote about how in 2009 people were focused on another type of bird flu, H5N1, in East Asia, and they didn't see the H1N1 strain that eventually caused the pandemic in 2009 arising in Mexico, and And I think it just shows that we do have blind spots in our ability to surveil for flu viruses. This is the disease that arguably we are best placed to detect and to monitor, and yet there are still blind spots. Africa is one of them. There are still large parts of Africa which have bird flu viruses, and where our ability to monitor them is still reasonably low. So I do still wonder about not just the threats like H7N9 that we are aware of, but the ones that we don't quite have our eye on yet.
Just a quick question on that before we take some calls. When you say that we're kind of blindsided by this, is it because medical professionals don't see it building in the animal population quickly enough and are not aware that it's got this capacity to leap to human populations? Is that one of the reasons? Yeah.
It's very hard when you think about surveillance. There are millions of potential viruses in animal populations, in all kinds of animal populations, wild and domestic, many of which we don't know about. Some of them have the potential to jump into humans. Which ones are they? How then do you find them? There are all these valiant efforts to look at these interfaces where humans and animals interact, and to try and find the viruses that lurk in those interfaces and might be jumping into people. But all of that takes a huge amount of manpower. It takes resources. It takes money to do the actual tests and sequencing work that might find those viruses. Those efforts are underway. But if you think about the fact that this is a global problem, that there are so many unknowns, and that there are so many places in which these spillovers could happen, meat markets, farms, it becomes a very difficult task to do the kind of monitoring that would really give us a handle on what is out there.
Okay. Call here from Emily in Minneapolis. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Carrie. I'm a physician with Health Partners, and I'm a specialist in occupational medicine. I had the opportunity in 2009 to participate in preparation, actually, as incident response to H1N1 virus.
Wow. Uh-huh.
So this is my area. Very interesting.
Glad you heard
you guys
it.
Are talking. Yes, I actually had someone text me that you guys were talking about.
Oh, good.
So I recently finished a certificate in public health preparedness response recovery at the U of M.
Mm-hmm.
While I'm not currently involved with any planning here, having had the experience of planning for even something like a flu pandemic, I know that resources are very limited, that advanced preparedness is not emphasized, and it's not so much the health system's fault as it is a matter of resources. Preparing for the totally unexpected is really difficult, and yet there are general principles that can be put into place, and I'd love to see more emphasis on that nationwide and more resources for all health systems. That being said, it is difficult to prepare for the completely unknown.
Right.
As your speaker said, there's millions of viruses and emerging diseases are a problem for infectious disease specialists, and so there are general principles that can be applied particularly for medical centers. I felt that the nationwide response to Ebola preparedness for medical centers was lacking. There was minimal training, and even here in Minneapolis, there were concerns about the Liberian community, travel. We had a number of phone calls, people very nervous about mm-hmm. what could be going on. And, in our clinic in particular, we could have people, we could have had somebody walk in to a clinic, not necessarily an emergency room, so there needs to be preparedness thought about in an entire medical system, not just hospitals, but also clinic-based systems and urgent cares. And I think that training on personal protective equipment is important. Staff preparedness is relatively easy to do, and yet the proper use of those preventive measures is often difficult to implement. I think the best thing that came out of Ebola was the screening question that happens at the front desk, which is, have you traveled outside the United States in the last 21 days?
Yeah.
And that really has to do with any emerging disease that could come from any country. It's not just, did you go to Liberia and Sierra Leone? It is, we now know about this situation in Canada. There was SARS in Canada.
Right.
You know, and so now that one question, just like there was more attention paid to hand washing after H1N1, you know, that's the one lasting thing from Ebola. But the other thing is institutional memory. Ebola was now 3 years ago, and, you know, nobody is really, it's not on anybody's mind. And so the thing about the field of emergency preparedness is it's after something happens that everybody gets interested.
Right.
And then when it goes away, we all lose interest and move on to the next thing.
Emily, that's exactly why Ed's article caught my eye, because I thought, this is not something that a lot of us have been talking about, but you can bet we will be the minute, you know, some new strain breaks out. Ed, I just want to follow on what Emily said there with something that you write in the piece. The U.S. is not unfamiliar with the concept of preparedness. It currently spends roughly $500 billion on its military, but against viruses, more likely to kill millions than any rogue state, is such consistent investments are nowhere to be found. I mean, is that just, it's the absence of something that we can't quite imagine, and we forget pretty quickly about the last time that it happened? Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's really the core problem here. And you know, thanks very much to Emily for mentioning this. You know, sometimes when we think about diseases, we think of it as a scientific or a technological problem. You know, it's about researching the viruses or making vaccines or cures or what have you. I see it as primarily a societal and a psychological and political problem. And really at the core of this is our inability to think past the duration of, say, a political electoral cycle to deal with threats that are inevitably going to happen, but at timescales that just go beyond our institutional memories. So we have these cycles repeatedly over time where a disease hits, people panic, they throw money at the problem, training goes up, and then the threat abates, and then resources disappear, people forget, they move on to the next thing. You see this in funding cycles for preparedness for hospitals, for training epidemiologists, for getting emergency funds put aside for dealing with these crises. You know, you get spikes in funding, and then they disappear over time very gradually, and then people end up end up in the same unprepared situation that they used to be. And I think that's the core problem here, this cycle of panic and neglect, which has has been going on for many decades. It transcends administrations, and it applies to all kinds of countries, both rich and poor, around the world.
Call here from Rolf in Apple Valley. Hi, Rolf. What are you thinking about?
Hi, I'm wondering what people individually can do to make them less likely to contract disease, if there's anything in their environment they could do. For instance, in Minnesota, we often see a spike in colds and flus in the winter when the conditions are dry and ideal for viruses. So is there anything just in general public health and maintenance that can help at least ameliorate the problem when it hits?
You know, there are a few things that spring to mind. Hand washing is something that our earlier caller mentioned, and you know that's a classic bit of infection control. To the extent where vaccines exist, and they might not, they are probably unlikely to, for anything that is new and emerging, I would recommend those. You know, it's difficult, right? Because I think that I don't want to go too hard on the individual choices bit, because I do think that these are societal problems. You know, there's a reason why this is really about public health. It's about getting prepared at a population level, about making sure that we have enough money, enough supplies. So, you know, I sort of don't want to give our listeners the impression that this is something that they themselves can mitigate if the world at large is not ready. You know, that's not going to be the deal breaker here. But in terms of individual individual actions. Actually, I think one of the things that's probably most important is trying to think hard about which sources of information you're relying on and trying to seek the best possible information in the event of a crisis.
That's a good point.
Yeah, you know, this is something that I think we've had problems with in the past when Ebola hit West Africa, causing the historically large epidemic of 2014-2015. There was so much misinformation, and there still is so much misinformation that circulates about that particular virus, this idea that people bleed through all their orifices or their organs liquefy, thoughts that you can catch the disease very easily, whereas none of that's true. It spreads through bodily fluids, not through the air. But there was so much misinformation about how the disease spreads, which people are at risk, where it's coming from, what measures are useful to control it. And I think actually by being savvier consumers of news and by, you know, taking a step back and trying to think hard about where we're getting our information from, that's possibly one of the most important things we can do in the event of something new that people are only just starting to learn about.
Yeah, I'm really glad you said that, because that can mitigate perhaps this cycle of panic, right? It mitigates the panic and it gives you a broader view, so that the neglect is something that, you know, average Americans can be aware of and be pushing their governments on. It's good to hear you saying this, Ed, that this is really in the hands of governments. While we like to think of ourselves as in control of being able to change a lot of what we may not like or that we want to be prepared for, this is really on the doorstep of our governments.
Absolutely, it is a political issue. You know, funding for public health has always been in jeopardy. You know, large funds that have been meant to train public health specialists and to shore hospitals up have dwindled over the last decade. Funds meant to help other countries improve their health security, to get better at detecting and preventing their own outbreaks, have also spiked a little bit recently, but are now threatening to fall again. And again, these are vast societal problems that hinge on our inability to really think far in the future for these threats that we can't really see and that we might not know about. I totally agree that this is at its core a political and society-wide problem.
Call here from Davida in Minneapolis. Hi, thanks so much for waiting.
Hey. Yeah, so I work in public health emergency preparedness, and while I do agree we need specific funding, I actually feel like we're most threatened by cuts to general public health funding. So I think, you know, the Affordable Care Act of people having access to health care was really, really great, because I do think people being able to have a clinic that they go to and they just get even basic care is really critical. And with the ACA, there was a pot of money put aside into a public health prevention fund. And even in Minnesota, we've definitely tapped into that fund to deal with a lot of the disease outbreaks and things that we've been facing here. So I really feel like people having food, access to medical care, and those investments are probably the more important to a pandemic than anything else.
That's a good point, Ed. And we know
totally
the constant
agree,
debate that goes on about that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I completely agree. You know, I'm not advocating for like a specific fund for like flu or Ebola or anything else. And in fact, that's almost counterproductive, because we don't know what the next threat is going to be. Maybe it's something that we've never seen before. And your caller is completely right that it's those it's funding that provides the foundations for public health, for our ability to deal with any threat that is really important. And unfortunately, it's kind of not sexy, right? It's not something that is very easy to make a case for, that really grabs people's attention, even though it is at the core of so much of what our health depends upon.
Call here from Kathleen in Apple Valley. Hi, Kathleen. What are you interested in here?
Yes, I had a question because I had both a great uncle who died over in France from the Spanish flu, and also my great aunt who was in Minneapolis. And my question was, why did this particular virus attack so many young people in their 20s and 30s? And my other question was, is my great aunt died within several days, and I was wondering, is that unusual to this virus, or is that something that is sometimes very typical?
Yeah, Ed.
So, you know, to the first question, a lot of the deaths from that flu strain are attributable to this thing called the cytokine storm, where your immune system basically runs riot in response to the virus. And it's sort of that that causes a lot of the problems. That kind of accounts for why people who were young and healthy and fit, who have strong immune systems, were so badly hit. You know, as to the specifics of how any particular case progressed, it's very hard to say. But you know, I think the consequences of that flu strain are very clear in how it affected the world and, you know, shaped the course of global events.
Ed, Mark asks kind of the same question here. Didn't the 1918 flu hit hardest the young and healthy? Do we know if that's true, or is that some mythology around the 1918 flu?
I mean, my understanding is that that's true, but you know, I am not a historian of the 1918 flu. I would recommend for people who are super interested in this to read an excellent book called Pale Rider by Laura Spinney, which really goes into depth into what actually happened and how the flu progressed over time.
He adds, how will we deal when first responders and healthcare workers are the most likely to be affected? To say nothing about just normal everyday workers that make the world go.
Yeah, such a great question. And that has historically been a problem in situations like SARS, in Ebola. Healthcare workers, are often the unsung heroes here. They are on the front lines. They are often those who become infected early. Some of this does boil down to the ability of particular institutions to prepare themselves, like we talked about at the start of this call, and like some of your callers have hinted at. The hospital that I visited in Nebraska, for example, does a really great job of training people to know to ask questions about travel history, to know how to don protective equipment efficiently, so that at the point when a new outbreak hits, they're not just trying to work out what to do from scratch. They're relying on muscle memory, on experience, on all of that training. So I think partly it's to do with how well people are trained, what they know. But you know, that also comes down to resources, right? Like, training takes money, it takes time, it again comes back to this question of how important do we think public health is? How many resources are the United States willing to channel towards this field, which keeps us all safe in the event of newfound threats? I think the answer that I've come to, and that I think a lot of our callers would agree with, is not enough.
Ed Yong is with us if you've just tuned in to the discussion, and we're talking about a piece that he wrote for The Atlantic titled When the Next Plague Hits. At 11 o'clock, Tim Walz, as we continue our one-on-one conversations with candidates for governor, and we'll open the phone lines. Feel free to listen and call in there to Paul in Minneapolis. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
Hi.
I've been wondering what happened to the Zika virus that was so prominent
Good
a
question.
Year or two ago.
Yeah, you mentioned Zika in the piece, Ed.
I do. Zika is a great example of things that we already know about and ignore coming to bite us later. Zika was discovered in the 1940s, and people kind of didn't know very much about it, didn't really see it as a big threat. And then it spread to South America, to Central America. Now we know that it causes microcephaly in babies, this condition where people are born with small heads. It causes an autoimmune condition called Guillain-Barré syndrome. The virus is a problem, and people knew about it, but no one knew what it would eventually be capable of. And I think that hint speaks to the unpredictability of these diseases. I think the fact that the caller has framed this in terms of what's happened with this disease that was big in the news also speaks to our forgetfulness that we've talked about already. Right. Zika is still out there. Zika is still a problem. The Zika problem is by no means solved, and it is spread by a mosquito that is still is also still a problem. So, you know, Zika hasn't gone away, but the attention that we've paid to Zika has dwindled, and that I think is again the core of the problem, that things make us scared and then fear subsides and we forget.
One of the things that I'm curious about is whether can a population that has been exposed to, let's say, a different strain of the flu be somewhat inoculated against another strain of the flu? Does any previous experience with a particular virus or a strain of a virus make a difference into how susceptible a population might be?
So it really depends on the virus, right? So, for example, we all know that if you get like chickenpox as a kid, that's it. You have a lifelong immunity to it, and the same for things like measles. Whereas something like flu is very different because that virus evolves very, very quickly, and new strains are coming up all the time with different characteristics to the ones that come before, which is also why the flu vaccine needs to change every year. It's this constant case of trying to keep up with an enemy that is constantly shifting. It's trying to hit a moving target.
I mean, this is why that guy said to you, it's like they're listening in on our conference calls. They're always the viruses are a step ahead of us.
Exactly.
Call from James in St. Paul. Hi, James. What are you curious about?
Well, first, I'd agree that getting a strong health infrastructure is really more important than almost anything. But I am also curious, has there been any movement internationally with agreements on what you do when an outbreak happens to prevent spread in a pandemic way? So, you know, screening at airports before people get on the airplanes or ocean liners or any sort of things that to kind of control the movement of that outbreak so that we can deal with it as an outbreak rather than a pandemic.
So not stopping it, but slowing it down.
At least enough so we can respond to it, yeah.
Yeah, Ed?
So, yeah, you know, I'm really glad that this point has been raised, because I think that is crucial. These are global problems by their very nature. And what happens in one part of the world can very easily spread to another part, given how interconnected we are, given how much air travel there is. So the best way to stop, to control and to curtail pandemics of the future is to ensure that every country is ready for them, that they have the resources and the ability to detect and to respond to new threats. And there is a responsibility, I think, on the part of richer nations like the US to help countries in the developing world to boost their health security. I think some people would argue that there is a moral imperative to that. I would feel the same way. But even if you disagree with the line of reasoning, I think there is also a selfish reason to make those investments in other countries' health systems. Just because by the time diseases that emerge in one place have a chance to spread around the world, it just makes it very harder to control them. It becomes much easier if you stop them at the point of origin. And this isn't about like richer nations sort of parachuting into poorer ones and taking over. It's about ensuring that all parts of the world have the skills and the resources they need to deal with their own outbreaks. There is a lot of historical examples where where that's really worked out. During the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, one case ended up in Lagos in Nigeria, one of the most populous cities in
Right.
Africa. Right. It was terrifying. And I think a lot of people were very rightly worried that this could be the start of a very new and awful phase of this outbreak. But Nigeria were ready. Nigeria had people who had been trained to eradicate polio, thanks to investments from other countries. And all of those trained people were then tasked to dealing with Ebola, with tracking all the contacts of the case that landed in Lagos. And they managed to control Ebola in one of the most densely populated cities in Africa with minimal spread. And I think that shows what it looks like when a place is more prepared for these diseases, and why we need to try and ensure that that's the case for all kinds of other hotspots around the world where new infections might emerge.
Kevin says on Twitter, "My main responsibilities for my job are protecting public health. What we need to start to become fully prepared is the support of the public. It doesn't seem that society is concerned about illness. They think that it's just a part of life." To Leah in St. Paul. Hi, Leah. What are you interested in?
Hi. I wanted to know if you address this in your book, but what about the breakdown of civil society with a pandemic like this? I understand during the 1918 flu epidemic, you know, public functions were canceled. You know, how are people going to get food? Are they going to be able to continue working? Are there going to be more isolation?
Ed, I've got about 2 minutes. I want to give you a chance to answer that.
Okay, so this speaks to some of the things we've talked about earlier about how this is a societal problem. I think one of the issues with epidemics is that they have this divisive quality, because people tend to fear their neighbors as potential sources of infection, and they have this tendency to tear communities apart. What we really need are leaders with a strong unifying spirit who can bring society together to stop those risks from happening. Now, you know, I want to leave you with a slight concern about whether the lead people in power at the moment are capable of that unifying spirit, and what kind of voice they are going to present in the event of something that has this societal divisiveness to it. Is the world ready for that in an era of isolationism and increasing partisanship?
Ed, this has been really interesting. Thanks so much. Thanks for the reporting and the time today.
No, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Ed Yong's book, and I want to recommend that. And if you look into if you Google Ed Yong, I Contain Multitudes in NPR News, you can hear our conversation. That's the name of his book. And the piece in The Atlantic is When the Next Plague Hits. Coming up at 11 o'clock, the next conversation, one-on-one with a candidate for governor, Tim Walz. We'll open the phone lines. I've been hearing from young voters who are really engaged in this all week, and I hope you'll chime in again at 11 o'clock. I'll see you then.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828. Or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.